I did not grow up watching Emergency. I did not have any family in the fire service or in EMS. I didn't know anyone who was an EMT, and I had no interest in riding a fire truck. You have to have this resilience and this foundation, or frankly, you're not going to have any longevity in your careers. It's that challenge of making sure that people are aware. Like, I can connect you with resources. There are a lot of resources, mental health and well-being, financial. And this is not just my job as an officer, but this is what I have accepted to do as a human being. And part of that is making sure that my people are okay. Not just the people that we go out and call 911, but the people who are here who carry a lot of that burden on their shoulders.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMT. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Captain Rami Duckworth about leadership, resilience, and mental health and EMS in the fire service. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Respond to Wellness, Inc. page, pbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is respondertv.com for all our past episodes. We'll be back to speak with Rami right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB. This episode is sponsored by the Angio Foundation. And today we're joined by one of the most recognizable leaders and educators in EMS and fire, both locally and nationally. He's also a friend and has been a mentor as a fellow officer, Captain Rami Duckworth. Ram is a dedicated emergency responder with more than 30 years of experience working in career and volunteer fire departments, hospital healthcare systems, and private emergency medical services. He's the recipient of the American Red Cross Hero Award and the Sepsis Alliance Sepsis Hero Award, and the EMS 10 Innovators Award. Ram is currently a career fire captain and paramedic EMS coordinator for the Ridgefield, Connecticut Fire Department. Ram's the author of chapters in more than a dozen EMS, fire, rescue, and medical textbooks, and has over 100 articles published in fire and EMS magazines. A member of the NAEMT Board of Directors, as well as other national and international advocacy and advisory boards, Ram continues to work for the advancement of emergency services professions. Ram, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's great to see you. It's great to be here, and it's great to be part of a really important discussion. I appreciate the invite.
Well, thanks for being here, and thank you for that long list, David, read, because really when someone has all of that behind them, it's because they care and they're here for the right reasons. So that's very visible to us. So thank you.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's jump right in. For those of us who are listening or watching who don't know you, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into first responder world?
Sure. I did not grow up watching Emergency. I did not have any family in the fire service or in EMS. I didn't know anyone who was an EMT, and I had no interest in riding a fire truck. until I was in my 20s, quite honestly. I came to it through a different path than a lot of people did. I was originally going to school for chemical engineering, and I learned through some internships that wasn't for me. Like a lot of people in college, you start in one path, and then I wasn't really sure what to do, but I knew that as part of college, I wound up taking a first aid course. And so when I moved back to where I live now in Connecticut, I asked around and said, well, you know, I don't know, I've got some time on my hands. I like this first aid thing. Where do you go from here? And people said EMT. So at the time, in order to do that, you had to join a local fire department or ambulance corps. And I joined a local fire department that had an ambulance. And they said, well, we'll sponsor you for EMT, but we need firefighters too. And again, I said, I don't know anything about it, but I got some time on my hands. Sure. So I wound up taking courses, and the more that I did it and the more courses that I took, that's how I discovered my passion. I really, really enjoyed doing it. It was the first time that rather than a more academic experience, I felt really connected to the work that the training was preparing me for. And the more I got better at it, the more I found that I also enjoyed sharing it. So I got more into teaching in sort of wider and wider circles. And so that's how I found my passion, and I continue still to enjoy talking about it like we are here, and sharing the information and learning from other people every day that I can.
You know, from what you said, there's, and also being an EMS myself, there's an instant gratification that is afforded to you. You take what you learned in that book or that class and you put it to work immediately, and you see the result in front of your eyes. So that's an important point that you made.
Let's go on a more personal note in terms of 30 years of experience working in EMS and fire, and just being out there in the field. Have you had any personal experiences with trauma that made you believe in the importance of getting help?
Yeah, absolutely. The first one that always comes to mind was locally with my local volunteer fire department at the time. And I was still in EMT class. I remember that I was in EMT class, and I happened to be in EMT class with a bunch of other people who were around during the daytime. And of course, for volunteers, that's a critical time. There's not always a lot of people who are available, and we didn't have any staffing at the time. So I remember that it was Valentine's Day, and it was an icy, yucky Valentine's Day morning, and there was a bad automobile crash. And to spare the details, it was a very traumatic crash in every possible way. It involved a fatality of a young person, and it was very, very bad trauma. And all of the people who were on in my EMT class, only about halfway through, were all on that call.
Wow.
And it was the first time that, even though this was a high school kid, I was still very young at the time. I was only in my early 20s. It was the first time I'd ever really sort of connected to that kind of thing for somebody about my age. And it didn't bother me at the time where I was on the call. We were all very focused on the call and the things that we needed to do and getting back in service and cleaning up the, you know, sort of the gore of it. And even though we were, you know, we were sort of up to our elbows, it, you know, reflecting back on it, like, oh my goodness, but we were all just go, go, go. You know, we were in go, go mode. And it wasn't until later that night that I was alone at home, and I started to dwell on it a little bit more. Just, you know, not even dwell on it, I should say. I started to reflect on it. It really started to bother me, and sort of a sense of my own mortality, and a feeling of, should I have been able to do more for this person? Why wasn't I further along in my EMT class? All of those natural kind of thoughts. And I was very fortunate that I received a call from one of the leaders in our volunteer fire department. And he said, like, hey, I know it was a really bad crash, and we're getting a bunch of people together at the hospital for a debriefing. And I had never gone through something like this. And it was an older style debriefing, and you know, the way we had done it years ago. And but it was my first experience with, wow, this is really impacting me in a way that is out of my control. And my first experience where someone reached out to offer help. And just being in a room with other people who were also very upset, some much more than I, it just made me feel better and realize that there was a pathway towards getting help, and that reaching out for help, and that maybe I should have been more proactive, and also thinking, well, you know, when I'm in a position to offer help, I need to be aware that there are other people who may need that kind of help, either in an acute, like this was a bad call, or maybe a chronic long-term setting. And I need to be that proactive and reach out to people to try and connect them with the help, even if it's not help that I can personally give them. And it really opened my eyes up early on.
Is that something you think you took in with you as an officer, as a captain, and in dealing with training people underneath you and inferiors?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was something that I'm very fortunate now in our department. Our department and our town are very supportive in that way, and they offer us a lot of options. But because we keep the conversations understandably private, it's walking a fine, you know, I'm still learning about how to carefully walk that fine line between making sure that an issue remains private and people feel comfortable bringing to me confidential information, and making sure that people are aware not only are these resources out there and people get it as more of just a, you know, verbalizing, like, hey, you know, there's help out there. Okay, yeah, no, I've heard there's help out there. Like, no, really. There are people in this department on your shift that are using this help. And, you know, you sort of don't, I don't want to out people for that because we are in a small department and, you know, that things travel very fast. But it's that challenge of making sure that people are aware. Like, I can connect you with resources. There are a lot of resources in a lot of different ways. You know, mental health and well-being, financial, you know, all of the things that tie into sort of that general wellness and well-being. And and again, I try to pass that on to other people as well, because we've got both the formal leaders. You know, I'm the shift commander, my lieutenant. But also the informal leaders, like the senior people in the department, and mm-hmm. and we have a new person on our shift, and I very much have a philosophy of, you know, if we're welcoming somebody to the team, they may be a new member to the team, but if they're going to be a part of the team, then they need to be to feel not like a second class citizen. They need to feel that they are a member of the team. So I even work hard to make sure that he knows, like, not only am I offering help to you, but if you see things that are not right and it seems like somebody needs help, then please bring it to me. Or if you don't feel comfortable with that, and I understand, I want to hand you the resources that you can direct other people to as well, so that we make sure that we're really trying to hit this from as many different pathways as we can.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
Well, I would love to dovetail on that, Ram, because I thought of like five questions I would ask you, but we'll start with this one. So you've held several officer ranks in a fire service and an EMS, and you're certified as an executive fire officer 4. And so you're uniquely qualified to weigh in on this. How can leaders in these departments stay current on the resources that are out there for health and wellness and for EMS and fire? And then do the same resources work for both EMS and fire?
I think that I'll answer the second question first to provide a little more context. I think that the resources generally work across public safety. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of resources that are universal for police, fire, EMS. Now, there are some resources that are very specific for law enforcement, very specific for fire, but the majority of them aimed at public safety. They're going to work across the board because we're all human beings. Mm-hmm. And certainly it can help to have somebody who understands the unique challenges and unique experiences of public safety professionals. But again, we're all at the core. We're all human beings. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we often function and respond to trauma in the fundamentally in a lot of the same ways to get us started. Pardon me. But as far as chief officers and executive officers, It's a matter of, to me, it's a matter of mindfulness. And I know this may sound silly, but I keep active lists of things that I need to take a moment, and I try and do this once a week, and sort of go down this just a fundamental list of checking in on particular topics. And sometimes it's not something I may be doing weekly. It may be doing as a once a month reminder. I have a little list that I pop in and once a month for my shift. And you know, am I getting enough private face-to-face time with people? Just as an example. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, in larger departments, I understand chiefs can't always do this, but chiefs can make sure that their shift commanders or however it works in the structure, that you're getting face-to-face time with your immediate subordinates or whoever it is, and make sure that they are getting the FaceTime and that everyone is getting enough, for example, that FaceTime, because so often we communicate people. I'm a very task focused individual. I'm very, you know, I'm getting to the next thing and I'm getting to the next thing. And I have structure throughout the day to make sure we're doing our thing. And I'll talk to the group and you get that group dynamic and you get a vibe of the group. But I think it can be very easy for some of us, especially as you move up in rank and you get more distance between the rank and file, that you forget that there are things that people will tell you and open up to let you know about them personally, as well as the shift and the department as a whole. Mm-hmm. That is amazing, necessary information about them and about, like I say, the groups and subgroups in your agency and your whole organization that you only get from that face-to-face, like, hey, let's just sit down and chat for a little while. So again, it may not always be possible for chief officers to get that, but you have to make sure that is occurring in your department and that there is that information flow. And for some of you, like me, that may not happen naturally. When I love the people that I work with, and they are truly family. But as Dave knows, Dave works with me, and I'm sure it's no surprise. I get very task oriented. And when I'm at work, I'm going from one work thing to the next work thing. And I'm very, it's hard for me to be in hangout mode when I'm at work. So that can be a real challenge, but I think that's the real key for certainly for wellness, and mental health and well-being, but also just for the function of your department. You're going to find out things like, oh, is that going on? I didn't even know that was going on. I thought I was aware of all of the, I hear enough rumors at the firehouse, but that's a completely new one. Let me make a note. We have to address that, or we have to take care of it, or we have to connect people with resources, you know?
Well, that's a great point in terms of being the officer, whether captain, lieutenant, because you are in daily content. Usually you're in daily contact with the shift and you can get the pulse of what's going on with the shift, but you're also got a huge agenda of things to take care of, whether it's training, taking care of administrative stuff, staffing, equipment problems. How do you keep this? I mean, you've kind of answered this by talking about your list, but how do you keep this in the mix and even prioritize having those conversations and making sure that you're making that personal contact with your shift mates or shift members, just to, you know, get a blood pressure, get a pulse on where they're at.
Well, I'll give you a sort of a live example of something I'm going through right now. As I say, we've had some shift change dynamics in our own small department, and we've got a couple of people left on our shift and a couple of new people came on. And I want to take a moment now that people are settling in, for me, it's an interview. But just, you know, to chat, as I just described, with people on the shift. And man, it's been a constant game of whack-a-mole, even more than usual lately, where we've had lots and lots of emergency calls. So we haven't even had time to do training. I mean, we're really just going from one to the next, and people are eating breakfast at you know, 5 p.m., those kinds of days. Plus, even when I may not be going on every ambulance call as the shift commander, I'm still going out on a lot of calls and playing shift commander whack-a-mole where equipment is breaking. Well, like I'm also way up there. So these face-to-face chances to you know, find out, hey, how are you doing? What do you think of the newer person? What challenges do we have? What's bothering you? What things are you not getting from me or the department to help you do the things that are going to make you happy and look forward to come to work? And so I've had to push it back and push it back. But as I have to push it back to the next shift, I make it move up on the priority list, if that makes sense. Like, okay. I mean, I literally physically have a list to manage it, because as the day-to-day stuff comes, and that's life for everybody, but you know, especially when you move up in rank, you're just playing that game of whack-a-mole, and it can be easy to just for months and months go, yeah, like at some point I got to talk to the people on the shift and get a little one-on-one time. And at the end of the day, as an officer, honestly, I'm exhausted. Like, I get exhausted, and it's tough for me to listen to people's problems, quite frankly. There have been a few shifts where I knew I was going to bring somebody in who had some stuff going on, and I felt like I'm a human being. I just don't feel like listening to it, but it's important, and I have to. So I get a fresh cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. I take a deep breath, and I go, this is my job. And this is not just my job as an officer, but this is what I have accepted to do as a human being. And part of that is making sure that my people are okay. Not just the people that we go out who call 911, but the people who are here who carry a lot of that burden on their shoulders. Like, it's my job to listen to them and suck it up for a little while, even if I don't feel like it, and just make that happen.
Right. It's just wanted to make one point and then go ahead, Bonnie. We just had a guest on, Christian Hinojosa from Dallas Fire, and he made this great observation that as a fire captain or company officer, he's not only outwardly facing to the public, but he's inwardly facing to the staff of the fire department. And so it's really it's a dual role, and takes more, energy and resilience as an officer to be able to fulfill both sides of that. Mm-hmm.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a National Alliance of First Responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources, and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ram. I recently finished a 2-year term as chief of service at my EMS agency, so I'm Captain COVID, if you will. So as you could imagine, you know, some of the things you're describing, I was going through the same thing. And there's one day I remember I was rushing to a meeting, right? I ran into the building to check the barcode or to check something for this meeting. And someone came up to me and said, hey, you know, can we talk? I need to talk to you. And this is somebody who never really seeked very much one-on-one. So I knew it was very important. And instead of kind of trying to listen haphazardly for 4 minutes before I got to this meeting, I looked them in the eyes and I said, look, I really, really want to talk to you. I really want to listen. I am rushing right now. And in fairness to you, to do right by you, can I call you in the morning? And I was honest. I communicated openly, which I think is a real lack in EMS leadership a lot of times. You probably agree. And then I made the time the next morning to follow through on the promise. And I called. And what would have been a 4-minute of a rush for me to check a box, and it would not have been validating for that person, the next morning it happened for 30 minutes on the phone. And everything they said could be heard, validated. I could respond appropriately. I could figure out what they needed from me next. So I think a lot of times when leaders make those kind of mistakes or those rushed moments, I don't think it's personal. But I think that when you take on these jobs, it is a responsibility, not just to the town or the city that you're in, but to your members, for you to be present with them. And if you can't do it in that moment, you have to find a time when you can do it. And I think, by God, those people are going to remember in the end. that they were heard. They're not going to care that they had to wait 12 hours. I think they're going to care about the quality they received and how they received it. And I love your example. And the one I just gave, I think there are things that everybody could make the time to do in that game of whack-a-mole. It's about priorities. And sometimes your people need to be prioritized over the equipment.
I 100% agree. And as you're mentioning and your great example, it occurs to me something that I very purposefully do. As I say, I'm a multitasking whack-a-mole kind of person. And I'm good at that. Honestly, I'm good at that. And, yeah. But when I'm paying attention to somebody, exactly as you say, I make a point of silencing my phone and my computer and turning the screen away from me and setting the stuff aside so that I don't inadvertently get distracted or make someone feel like they're troubling me.
Right.
Because they're interrupting me while I'm in the middle of doing a lot of other stuff. And as you say, and again, that's important for the specific topic that we're talking about, but that's just a good human being thing. And so often, just in the genre of leadership, I found, man, so often people just want to be heard and they want to get some stuff off their chest. Mm-hmm. And if you're like, oh man, people at work just complain. Sometimes if they feel heard by you, because you're, as you described, like, look, I'm right in the middle of something right now, but I want to give you the time. And when they feel heard because you gave them that time and they know you're paying attention and listening and responding to that,
right,
it diffuses so much. It won't fix everything, but I have personally been amazed at how much better my relationships are with people when they feel like, oh, I see Ron bopping around. But when he sits down and listens, he's really listening. He may not always agree with me, but he cares about what I'm saying and that it's upsetting me.
Right.
This is not a skill that's taught, obviously, in any kind of officer training, at least not that I'm aware of. So how did you acquire your skill set with this? Was it, you know, some role that you held, or did somebody mentor you or give you some sort of guidance on this? Like, how do you, well, if you were going to talk to an emerging, you know, an officer who's just got promoted to lieutenant and give him some advice on how to talk to his crew and do what you're doing, make sure that you make the time, like, what would you tell him?
I have to credit my wife for my wife Betsy for a lot of this. Is that honestly we do disagreements really well, and I have to admit that, like, even when we're upset with each other, she's much more mature than I am, and I'm always thinking, like, even if I think she is flat out wrong, she is such a good listener that honestly, like, you know, she'll give me feedback about stuff and like not just personally, but even with, you know, with some work stuff, because she's been in the field too. So she understands emergency services to some degree. And she'll tell me when I'm, you know, when I'm wrong or when I'm doing something wrong and say, like, you know, yeah, I get it. You're trying to get stuff done, but you got to just stop and sit down. Mm-hmm. And likewise, as a dad to a, you know, weak 8-year old, I do some work from home. And when my son comes up and he wants my attention, like, he knows now, very much like you said, like, sometimes I'm at work, even though I'm sitting at home, and I have to finish my thing. But when I'm finished, I'm going to pay attention to you. And I try and make sure that he's doing the same, because he's a little kid who likes YouTube and video games and doing like 5 different things at once. And I, again, try to relay that to him, because it bothers me when he does that. Like, dude, we're talking, stop and look at me. And it's that eye contact. And where that comes from is actually the executive fire officer program, you know, aside from those two personal, like where I get a chance to implement it, I guess, Dave, to answer your question, where the original source was, I did a research project for my executive fire officer program on patient care handover. So I looked at critical communications points where people have to come in. It's absolutely critical that communication occur effectively because it's a military situation or an incident command situation or a crashing patient handover situation. And how do those communications work effectively? And so much of it is exactly the stuff that we've been describing. Eye contact, putting away stuff that you're doing, you know, someone who is taking a patient report like this is not really listening to you. Stop. There has to be eye contact. You know, we have to isolate other things as best we can. We can't always do that in every situation. Sometimes the firehouse is still noisy or the command ground is still noisy, but it all circles around to the stuff that we've been talking about. So although that was a individual research project that I did, it was part of the sort of the bigger executive fire officer program. And it made me say, hey man, this isn't just for when I have to give a patient over at the hospital or I'm transferring command or intaking a report. These are all just good communication, effective communication techniques.
Right. And it's being present, I think, right? It's in that moment, whatever it is that you're doing. And a lot of these are extremely critical tasks. It's just being present to what you're doing and doing it with 100% of focus.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to pivot a little bit. You had mentioned before you're on the NAEMT board. So can you tell us a little bit about their new mental health resilience online program? Because I think it's relatively new and I'd love to hear more about it.
Yes, it's a great program. It's online. It's relatively short. I have to admit to you, it is literally on my list to complete tomorrow because I've had a chance to hop on to take a look at it.
Yeah.
But I haven't been able to, as the aforementioned numerous calls in whack-a-mole. So I haven't been able to complete the program. I've started it up a couple of times and then we, you know, off to the races as often happens. It's something that from being involved in NAEMT and their education programs, I know they wanted to set this as a priority. And they wanted to make it available to everybody so that there's at least one person in every agency across the United States who's got the fundamentals. And certainly you could go more there's you know, certainly more to the topic than you're just going to get in that program. They said, you know, every agency needs at least one person who's deeply aware of the more subtle signs and symptoms of somebody who needs to have you reach out to them and what the resources are to help connect these people that are just, as we said earlier, universally available. And it's unfortunate because, you know, there are resources like this, like what we're doing right now that are available to people that so many people just don't know about. So I think NAEMT is trying to use their leverage of their communication channels to make sure that these are people are just more aware of the resources out there.
Well, I think it's brilliant. And I'm going to promote it more and more because I think it's just such a wonderful opportunity. And you're right. If people don't know any of this, like has happened historically in EMS, especially, you know, went decades with none of this information. So now that we have it, I just think it's a great way to promote it. So thanks for talking a little bit about it.
Absolutely. And I have to tell you, one thing that breaks my heart is that I recently completed chapters for a popular EMT textbook and a popular paramedic textbook. And the responder wellness chapters were ones that I wrote. And I finished both of those before this program came out. And I really wish that we could have included that. And in the next edition, we definitely will. Because for both of those, you know, I was thrilled that the publishers and the editors of these textbooks said, we want more resources like that to be right up front. And we want these chapters rewritten in a way where it's not the chapter that you plow through so that you get to the cool stuff of splinting and bandaging, right, which is what, you know, EMT and even paramedics, yeah, that's the stuff that they want to get to. But really, we need it rewritten in a way that says, this is a fundamental part. Without this part of your foundation, you're not going to be able to do any of this other stuff that you're going to read about in later chapters, because you have to have this resilience and this foundation, or frankly, you're not going to have any longevity in your career. So I'm sorry that resource wasn't one that was included, but as we've been talking about, I'm glad that there's a greater recognition that, like, look, up front, we need to make sure that students are connecting with this at the very outset and the beginning of their career.
The doctor told me the answer, and now my head is spinning. He said I'm leaving with cancer, and my journey is just beginning. I'm stressed out and afraid. I have cried and I have prayed. To quiet my mind and be still. Take a deep breath and just chill. I put in my earbuds and decompress. Touch play on the app to ease my stress. I'm choosing peaceful relaxation with loving meditation. I'm loving meditations.
This episode is sponsored by the Angio Foundation, a public trust supporting first responder health and safety through prevention and early detection of cancer. And I'm curious, what is in those chapters? Like, can you give us a little kind of overview of what types of topics you're talking about in those chapters you wrote for those books?
Sure. Well, you know, it's a lot of stuff that physical safety and there's a lot to put in there. And I have to be honest, it was challenging to decide on what approach to take so that each important thing gets the appropriate focus, because, hey man, back safety is important, and lifting and moving properly, right? Ergonomics, scene safety and situational awareness and active scenes of active violence. You know, these are all things that are challenging to get across to a new student who may have no context and no experience to connect with these kind of ideas. Mm-hmm. Like, they're reading the words and they go, yep. If someone has a gun on scene, that's hazardous. But, like, they haven't had that context where they've had a partner be threatened by someone else with a weapon, or have worked with someone who has been had a career ending injury, physical injury, you know, something like that. And then I look at the mental health side of things and think, wow, this is going to be even more of a challenge for new people. I know that it was for me. And you know, some people may have a connection to it, but a lot of the people coming into these classes with no public safety experience, and probably a lot of them, not a lot of life experience, like, how are they going to connect to this? So I wish that there were ways to put more into that program, but we tried very hard to focus on the key points for physical safety and ways they could connect, and the key points for mental health and well-being. And for that stuff, I honestly tried to take out the stuff that I thought was just going to be obvious to anybody. The stuff that an EMT may look at and go, okay, I won't get drunk every night. Or, you know, some of this stuff was sort of so obvious that I'm like, this is a list of 25 things. And as a new EMT student reading this, if I feel like 20 of them are obvious, then yeah, I'm going to put some of the fundamentals in, but that's going to make me skip this whole list. And now I've undermined, you know, I'm not interested in any of this. I'll memorize a little bit of it to pass the test so that we could just move on from this stupid chapter of lists. So I tried to put in some more of that personal experience and try to make it a little bit more specific and something where an EMT student, you know, we're not trying to scare them, but to make them go, oh, okay, This is important. This is as important as everything else. And if I don't get this foundation, I'm not going to be good at cardiac and trauma and all of that other stuff, because I'm not going to have that resilience that's necessary to serve the patients that I'm trying to take this class for. That's a little bit less than an outline, but it was more the important thing for me was the approach that we took to it was to try and make the chapter interesting and engaging, or we're not going to get any of that information across.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. As someone who's, you know, been in a lot of courses and read a lot of textbooks, we typically don't get an insight into the author's, you know, process and perspective in writing these things. So that's it's interesting stuff. Thanks for sharing it.
Sure.
We've been fortunate enough at my agency. So I've gone in actually myself to the last 3 or 4 EMT classes and given a lecture for 90 minutes on trauma, PTSI, and how to get it treated. So we're giving our brand new EMTs to go through our class the knowledge before they get in the back of that rig. And I think we would all agree that's where people need it. They need it in the fire academy, the police academy, and EMT and paramedic programs. So you putting it in that textbook makes it relevant and it makes it a priority.
And you just reminded me of something. I just had this conversation. I'm talking about the EMT textbooks. I'm currently working on the Firefighter 1 and 2 textbook. I'm actually going back to revise. I've already written a similar chapter for that, but I'm going back to revise it because I talked to the editors and said, look, there's a lot of stuff that I want to cut out of some of these chapters because they just belong in, like, here's the fundamental stuff. And there's a lot of things I would love to say, but they're like whole other courses. And I have to stay focused on the reader is in this case, a Firefighter 1 student. Like, they want to get to, again, the throwing ladders and the chopping with axes and chainsaws, and they'd be fighting fire, right? But we went back to them and said, like, look, just because it should be another separate lecture, like you're saying, or not lecture, but, you know, a whole separate course or section, can we pop out links to any of this? So, you know what? Not every student is going to do it, but it helps keep students engaged. So everybody gets the fundamentals. And if anyone has a hint of interest in learning more about these topics, we're not bogging everyone down. They can click out to a link to their specific interests. We're serving their interests more, which makes a better textbook. And we're getting this critical information out to people who are hopefully champions of this, like you guys are, and to have somebody in that class who maybe not the instructor for the class, but a couple of other people who have gone further to engage in this information, and now they know a little bit more about it, that hopefully they'll be able to spread that information throughout the class, even with the other people who would normally just, you know, flip through those pages if we just put everything in the textbook.
One more question, and it has to do with what you're talking about. It relates to sort of the new generation of firefighters, EMTs, paramedics that are coming up through the ranks. Now you've got like 30 years of experience, and you've probably seen a lot of people come into the profession. Do you see any difference with the current generation in terms of their openness and willingness to seek help or to talk about mental health? Is there something unique or different about the younger crop of people that are coming in?
Yeah. And I should mention, by the way, the reason I'm all scruffy is I just got back from a week of training where I didn't have to shave. And if I don't, I won't. but this was one of the topics we were talking about. And I have to admit, there were a bunch of people who were sort of griping about, senior people who were sort of griping about, you know, the problems with the new generation. And I brought up the fact that, you know, okay, well, first of all, it's very easy and it feels good to generalize, but man, it's tough to talk about individual people. Cause I look at some of the newer people and it's a wide variety, and some buck the heck out of me. And some I would love to invite over for Thanksgiving dinner. but it's tough, but broader as a crop, I would say that they tend to be more open, and it can be more challenging in my personal experience. It could be more challenging for senior people to deal with some of that openness. And I don't like to see either formal leaders like officers or informal leaders like senior people just constantly trying to shut that down with the, you know, hey, this is our culture is shut up until you've got 10 years on. And then maybe you'll have something interesting to contribute at, you know, and as I say, I'm very much, look, if we're welcoming them as part of the team, then they have to feel like part of the team. And if they got something to say, then they need to open up. And a big part of that, Dave, is exactly what you're saying. Like, I don't want anybody to feel like they're just being shut down if they're going to be open. You know, you know, sometimes let them know, like, hey, what, you got two ears and one mouth, so listen a little bit more to get the context so that you know what's going on, right? But yeah, you know, your opinions are valid, and I want your different perspective. I want everybody's perspective, and I hope that will also let them, you know that, hey, this is open communication. So if you've got something bad or something that's troubling you, we want you to be able to share that too. And, you know, that's okay. That's, you know, we're open to that. And that certainly tends to be a lot more than the people who, whether it was just their generation or like I was brought up in a culture that was just shut up for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear anything from you, whether a call bothered you or you've got a better idea, you don't know anything, let me know when you got a decade on.
Right. So Ram,
yeah.
How can people find you out there on internet, social media, anything like that?
Well, I've got a couple of websites, but I'll let you know that my parents blessed me with the name of Rami Duckworth. It's really easy to Google, and I'm going to be the only one you find. but ramduck.com. And rescuedigest.com are my websites. And I don't sell t-shirts and bumper stickers. So, it's all just, engaging with people and, in emergency services and sharing resources. So, you know, feel free to reach out to me there or on Twitter at RomDuck. And I always love hearing from people and getting a chance to talk to people. And I travel around and teach in a lot of different places. So, you know, we may start communicating electronically, and I may be out somewhere where I can meet you face to face.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your expertise, knowledge, and humor. It's always a pleasure. And this was a great conversation. I'm sure is going to be impactful. So appreciate you.
Thanks, Dave. I really am always happy to get any chance to talk with you, but especially when we're talking about something as important as this, I really appreciate the opportunity.
This episode is sponsored by the Angio Foundation. We would like to invite everybody to like and subscribe. YouTube, we're on Responder Resilience channel. Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., bpsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is respondertv.com for all the past episodes and guest information. Until the next time, stay safe. Be kind to yourself. Take care.